vehicle donation program can help. Just call 877-WLRN-CAR, 877-957-6227, or donate online at WLRN.org. Donating is easy when the tow truck comes to your home and picks up the vehicle. They give you the paperwork that you'll need and relieve the stress of what to do with the old car that just won't sell. That's 877-WLRN-CAR or donate online at WLRN.org.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman on this Monday afternoon. Sometimes we know when death is imminent, sometimes not. We'll quote author Thomas Mann from his book Death in Venice. A man's dying is more the survivor's affair than his own. Indeed. Joining us now is Scott Taylor Smith. After grappling with grief and post-mortem details after his mother's death, he wrote, When Someone Dies, The Practical Guide to the Logistics of Death. Scott Taylor Smith is an attorney and was still bewildered by the ordeal. And he joins us from public station KQED in San Francisco. Welcome to you, Scott Taylor Smith.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Well, as Joe just mentioned, as an attorney, we might assume you were well-equipped to deal with all the logistics of settling your mom's estate, but that wasn't the case. So tell us about the circumstances of her death and the ensuing complications for you.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. My mom was a very healthy 85 years old, and she fell down in a parking lot and hit her head and basically had a hematoma in the brain and died about 10 days later from that. So while she was older and we knew she was, you know, nearing the end of her life, her death was quite unexpected. And I was her executor. I also had her medical power of attorney before she died, which I'll talk about in a minute. And the interesting thing is, as an attorney, I know all about the paperwork. I know how to write a trust document, how to write a will. But what I didn't know was all of the practical things that you have to do to actually implement those things. And it starts immediately upon the death of someone. We transported my mom from her retirement community to a mortuary, which is itself a complicated choice process. And the first thing the woman at the mortuary said, who was a fabulous person, said, how many death certificates do you want? And I looked at her and very confidently said, one will be plenty. And she took my hand and said, I actually think you might need a few more. And I looked at her and said, no, one will be plenty. Well, she turned out to be right, of course. I needed about 25. And the reason is every financial institution, the banks, the Social Security, even the post office, they all require an original copy of the death certificate. And the mortuary typically provides them for free or for very little money. And if you don't get them from them, then you have to spend time at the county offices and pay quite a bit of money to get them down the road.
So the first thing is get 2 to 3 dozen original copies of the death certificate.
Well, exactly. Let's look at how many accounts the person had. So, for example, if the person had 4 or 5 checking accounts or banking accounts and 5 or 6 credit cards, you know you're going to need at least a dozen.
Tell me, immediately after death, the body must be dealt with, and there's many options available. Funeral homes require a deposit, and the hospital really wants that body gone pronto.
They do. And one interesting thing, about 50 years ago or so, most people had prepaid their funeral expenses. They had already selected a plot, a family plot, and they had already made arrangements for a funeral home to take care of things. In today's sort of transient world, that is not the case, and the vast majority of us have made no arrangements. So when someone dies, you have to first make a decision as to which mortuary to transport him or her to, and then you have to start making all of the decisions about what type of arrangements you want. One of the things that we recommend very strongly is that you have what we call the Thanksgiving conversation with your parents before they die, because it's very important to figure out what that person wanted. Did they want to be cremated? Did they want a memorial service? Did they want a funeral, a religious type of celebration or commemoration? A lot of people today are green, and the environmental movement is opposed to putting a embalmed corpse in the ground, and they urge cremation. My mother, thankfully, had been very specific in her instructions. She wanted to be cremated. And here's the interesting thing. The mortuaries, most of them are highly, highly ethical, very sophisticated institutions, and they're really there trying to do good in the world. But it's also the case that they're for-profit institutions. And most mortuaries work on a per-service basis. So every time you transport the body, that's a fee. If you order flowers or if you order a coffin, you're paying for that. And I'll give you an example. When my mom got to their funeral home, they tried to sell me a coffin for her cremation. Mm-hmm. And they even made it sound like this was almost required by state law. And the truth is, you don't need a coffin. You don't need anything for cremation. And so I didn't order one. They also try to sell you an urn. I mean, obviously, this is your mother. This is, you want something beautiful for her to repose in. But we knew that she wanted her ashes distributed at the same place where her husband's ashes had been distributed. So we were only going to keep her in a box for a very short period. So I told them we didn't want an urn. And again, they sort of looked at you as if you were doing something wrong because they were going to deliver mom to us in a cardboard box. But that was exactly what we did. After, so you have to be just very careful.
After a death, though, is it morbid to shop for a mortuary?
Buying a car? Honestly, you should shop, and you should shop before the death. The prices vary wildly among mortuaries, and also you want to look at the convenience. One of the issues we had in my mom's circumstance was my baby sister is a Buddhist priest, and she is very, very committed to many Buddhist principles. One of the principles of Buddhism is that after someone dies, you leave them in rest in their home for a period of days. And the notion is that allows the soul to leave the body and leave peacefully in the place where they lived. So we decided we would do that for my mom. My mom was in the skilled nursing facility at her retirement community, so we wanted to move her body just about 100 yards from there to her apartment. Well, it turns out you can't touch a dead body. The only person who can touch a dead body is a licensed funeral person. So we had to have the mortuary come and move her to her apartment for a day, and then they came back, and each of those actions was a fee.
Going back just for a minute, you said your mom, wanted to be cremated and you knew that. What if there are no directives? How does one proceed, and who pays for the funeral expenses?
Good questions. The first one is if there is not an executor of the estate, and let me take a step back and clarify this. Before mom dies, let's say mom may have given somebody the power of attorney to make either medical decisions or even financial decisions. If there is an existing validly signed power of attorney, then the person who has that power of attorney has the authority to make all of the decisions about mom before she dies. However, the moment mom dies, that power of attorney expires. And the person who then takes control of the affairs, takes control of the estate, is the executor. And the executor is normally the person appointed in the person's will. Now, Bonnie, your question is, what if there's no will? What if there was no designation? And in that case, most state laws provide very specifically an order of executorship. So it's typically the surviving spouse. If there's no surviving spouse, the son or the daughter. If there are no children, it can be the parents, and then from there, cousins and broader family. You're not obliged to become an executor. Even if you're named in the will, if for convenience reasons or other reasons you don't want to do it, you may decline that. And most people in a will say, well, if Scott won't do it, then Terry will do it. And you do it that way. If you don't have a will, then what you do is you become an executor by designation or attestation. So typically the surviving spouse would sign a document that says, I declare that I am the executor of this estate, and most people will accept that.
I had a question, and it just flew right out of my head, but one of the things that occurs to me when you lose somebody and you're in this state of grief, I've had the experience, you're not up to really notifying people. You're not up to picking caskets. You're not up to all that, even if there are directives.
Oh, it's terrible. And, this is the most profound grief you'll ever go through. And people are sitting there waiting for you to make serious decisions. And it is very hard. one of the things that we encourage people to do, you know, it's interesting. In this country, death, people treat death like it's a communicable disease, and you sort of run away from it. And it's just about the worst thing you can do to someone you love. So I urge friends, and especially family, to go over and be with the survivors and make sure they're being taken care of. One of my partners in New York several years ago lost, in just a terrible tragedy, his six-year-old son. And the family was just destroyed by grief, and it was completely unexpected. I flew back to New York and sat down with them and helped them write the obituary. And I just got them talking about the obituary, and we wrote it. And it really was a beautiful exercise because it helped them divert their attention to something that was fundamental and real. And then, of course, we published that in the New York Times. I should say something about obituaries. You know, obituaries are not required by law. You do not have to post an obituary. And almost all newspapers charge quite a bit of money. It's a profit center for the newspapers, and they charge per word. So it's very important to think about, what did the person want? What would make, you know, mom or whomever happy? And would they want an obituary? And if so, where would they want it? What paper would they want it in? One good piece of news, for my mother, we wrote a long and a short form obituary. She had gone to Cornell Medical School and Wellesley College, and we sent the long-form obituary to both of those organizations, plus a bunch of charities that she had worked for, and they voluntarily published those in the alumni magazines.
Right, so you didn't have the expense of the long obituary in the paper.
That's right.
We're speaking with Scott Taylor Smith. He's an attorney and investment banker. He's written When Someone Dies, The Practical Guide to the Logistics of Death. On today's Topical Currents, we're going to give out the number when we come back from this short break and take your calls and your emails. Stay with us.
This is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. South Florida Theater League and 91.3 WLRN offer same-day, half-price tickets at leading regional theaters and cultural organizations, including Palm Beach Drama Works, Gable Stage, City Theater, and Kuyaki at Area Stage. Information and a complete list of shows online at culturalconnection.org. culturalconnection.org, your ticket to the cultural arts. We're funded by listeners like you and by All Air of South Dade, offering air conditioning solutions and service in Miami-Dade County. For more information or to schedule an appointment, you can simply dial star cool from your cell phone. That's *2665 and send.
You can join in a magical night of fairies, feasting, fire dancers, poetry, theater, and music, celebrating the art and artists of the Keys. The Centennial Bank's 7th Midsummer Night's Dream and Spectacle, Saturday, June 22nd, at the Key West Tropical Forest and Botanical Garden. Midsummer's Night Dream and Spectacle, June 22nd, 5 to 11 p.m. Midsummer's Magical Attire is encouraged. Presented in part by the Monroe County Tourist Development Council. Directions and ticket information available at KeyWestUpdates.com.
And we return. It's today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, and we're talking about death with Scott Taylor Smith. He's an attorney, and he's the author of When Someone Dies, The Practical Guide to the Logistics of Death. Scott Smith, I know sometimes families get into a real squabble when someone hasn't put the family heirlooms in the will, and they have to decide who gets what, who gets grandma's music box or the sewing machine, the china, the silverware, and some really bad family skirmishes can arise. How can we prevent that?
Oh, very good question. And I also want to go back to Bonnie's question about who pays funeral expenses, which I didn't answer.
Right.
You know, first of all, you have to decide whether the estate is in probate or not. If it's in probate, different rules apply. Probate is a court-mandated disposition of the estate, and typically in most states you're going to have to hire an attorney. The good news is for about 99% of us, we're not going to go through probate because the estate isn't large enough to qualify. In California, for example, if the assets of the estate are less than $150,000, you don't have to go through probate, and the executor can just simply dispose of the assets and and pay the debts by herself or himself. One of the questions, let me talk about debts before I get to the sterling silver. One of the questions that Bonnie, you asked before the break was, who pays the funeral expenses? And this is a broader question about who pays all of the debts of the deceased after they pass away. Now, with funeral expenses, the only person who has to pay those expenses is the deceased. And so if the deceased doesn't have the money to pay for it, nobody has to pay. But if you don't pay, if the family doesn't pay, you end up sending mom basically to a pauper's grave. We've all heard that term. And counties, you know, by law, are required to provide a disposal of the remains if the family won't pay for it. Hopefully, most families can find a way to contribute for that. But let's think about debts for a minute. Suppose I have a brother who has had a very rich life, but he never made any money. He lives in a rental apartment. And when he dies, he has, you know, $15,000 in his bank account, but he owes Visa and MasterCard $60,000. Not uncommon these days.
Right.
Well, the question comes up, do I have to pay those debts of my brother, or does my mom have to pay those debts? And the answer is emphatically no. And credit card companies will try to convince you otherwise. They will hound you to death to try to collect on those. And the answer just simply is no, with three exceptions. And by the way, if you don't fit into one of these exemptions, what you do is just send a death certificate along with the last bill to the credit card companies, and pretty much all the time they will go away. It's just not worth it for them to pursue you. But here are the exceptions. Let me change the facts a little bit, and let's say right before my brother dies, he won the lottery, and he had $200,000 in his bank account. And because I'm his heir, I'm going to get the $200,000. In that case, because his liquid assets exceed the debts, I have to pay those debts off. I am legally obligated to pay those off. Another exception is when there are spouses involved. And this varies a little bit by state law, but many states have what is called community property, or they look at the marriage as a communal event. And in those cases, and this is true for most states, if you are the surviving spouse and the debts were incurred on behalf of the marriage, then you actually do have to pay those as well as the surviving spouse on an ongoing basis. I'm drawing a blank on the third exception, but I'll think about it in a minute.
Just let me ask you a question about something you just said about the $200,000 you inherited from your brother and you have to pay off the debt because you inherited
More.
Do you have to also pay taxes on the $200,000?
No, you don't. This is fun. Everything you inherit comes to you tax-free.
Aha. Uh-huh.
But here's a good question. Does the estate have to pay taxes? And this is very complicated. There are four types of taxes that could come due for after someone dies. The first is, if he or she worked for part of the year, he might have income tax. So let's say you die in June. Well, you worked for 6 months, therefore you have an income tax burden for that 6 months. In addition, if after someone dies, the estate makes money. So let's say you left that $200,000 in a savings account and you actually earned money on it before it was distributed to you, well, then the estate would technically have a potential income tax due. And then the worst is what we call the death taxes. And we hear about this being talked about in Washington all of the time. For years, this country has had an estate tax, which means when someone dies, you look at the value of the estate, and if it's over a certain amount of money, to the extent it exceeds that, you have to pay a death tax on the value of that estate. And the number, that percentage that you have to pay, has varied wildly ever since the second George Bush was president. For a period of time, it was basically zero, which meant that you didn't have to pay any taxes at all. Today, for estates that are valued at around over $5.2 million, to the extent it's over that, you have to pay an estate tax of around 40%, which can be very high. But the great news is if the estate pays the tax, once you distribute the money to the heirs, it is completely tax-free to the beneficiaries.
Our telephone number. Go ahead.
The fourth tax would be state death taxes. Many states also have a similar tax like the estate tax.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in the discussion, 1-800-743-9576. Also email, that's radio at WLRN.org. And also you can tweet us, that's at Topical Currents. First caller, we've got Chelsea in Fort Lauderdale. Hi.
Hi, I'm enjoying listening to your discussion. I actually work at a local funeral home, and I just had a couple of corrections for you. I noticed you got a couple of mistakes in there. The first one is that obituaries are very expensive. I know that, but they charge by the line, not by the word. So that's something you might want to keep in mind. The other thing is with the death certificates. Don't let anyone pressure you into getting any number of death certificates. No funeral home should charge you a fee for getting death certificates. The only fee you pay for obtaining death certificates from the county health department is to the health department. In Broward County, it's $15. So if you order two death certificates, you should pay no more than $30.
Well, he mentioned that the mortuary will give you the death certificates and they get plenty of them.
Yeah, free of charge.
Yes, the attorney mentioned that the funeral home should provide them for you for free, and that is not the case.
Oh, Chelsea, I completely agree. Thanks. Both comments, I agree. There are some papers that charge by the word. The New York Times charge by the word. A lot of papers charge by the line. You're absolutely right about that. And also, I do want to correct that. Most funeral homes will just pass along the county fee and not a surcharge. And I agree with you completely.
I have so many questions going back when you were talking about the debts that your brother had, you know, all this $15,000 in the bank and whatever, $60,000 in credit card debt. How do we find out about all the outstanding debts? And what about if someone leased a car or has mortgage payments? I mean, what do you do with all those things?
Oh, great, great series of questions. Let's talk about the mortgages and the cars first.
Okay.
Where you have a purchase obligation on a piece of property, like a mortgage or a car, the debt actually travels with the thing. So when mom dies and leaves a house with a mortgage, the mortgage stays with the house. So the person who inherits the house inherits the mortgage. And you don't have to pay it off. You just continue paying it as if it for whomever lives in the house according to the terms of the mortgage. Similarly with car payments. And let me talk about the house for a minute because this is one that plagues people. And I have a special box on this in the book. Let's say mom dies and she leaves the house in Toledo, Ohio to three children. And one of the children lives in Toledo. The other two live in Los Angeles. And obviously the one who lives in Toledo wants to move into the house with her family.
Mm-hmm.
And mom has a mortgage, she has taxes, she has a gardener, lots of things, lots of expenses. When mom dies and very emphatically in her will says, I leave that house to each of my three children in equal shares. So the question is, what do you do after mom dies?
You'd have to sell it, right?
No, you don't. This is interesting. You have to sell it if you don't agree. But if you can agree, here's the interesting thing. Every one of you as a co-owner of that house owns that house, in terms of the law, 100%. So each of you is entitled to possess the property 100%, and each of you is 100% responsible for all of the costs and the cost of the mortgage. So how do you settle that when one sister is going to live there and the other two don't want to? Well, if you can reach an agreement where the sister who moves in will pay the rent, and typically the way we negotiate that is the rent is equal to all of the expenses. So one sister agrees to pay all of the expenses on the property in exchange for living there. And then when she finally is ready to sell the house, or we agree to sell the house, then we all split the profit on the house equally in thirds. That's a very fair resolution, although there are many ways you can solve it. Now, Joseph, to your point, if you can't agree, but we all know most families have trouble with this,
right.
If you can't agree, then any one of those three people is entitled to sue for what's called partition. And you file a very short form notice with the court that says, I own a third of this house and I want to sell it. And the court will mandate a sale typically within 60 days.
What if the daughter in Toledo who's paying the expenses, that was all fine and dandy and they agree, but then suddenly there has to be a $20,000 roof put on or something?
Well, it's what you negotiated. Typically, in most negotiated things, she would be responsible for that because she had agreed to pay all of the expenses. Sometimes when you come up to vacation homes where you have the same issue, families will agree, I will be responsible for all repairs and maintenance, but if people want to add a bedroom or want to fix, put on a new roof, that has to be done on a voluntary basis, and I don't have to pay if I don't want to.
Well, if you don't, if she doesn't want to pay for the new roof, the sister in Toledo, then who pays for it?
Well, you can, any one of the siblings can pay for the roof and can file a lien against the property so that when the property is sold, they actually get their money back for the roof.
They get an extra $20,000.
Yes, they get an extra. And by the way, if you pay for the roof and you want to get paid back, you absolutely must file that with against the property or you will lose your right to claim that. I want to go back to the sterling silver because it's such an important question for families. And remember, in most cases, each of us inherited a third of the silver, a third of the china, and a third of mom's jewelry.
Unless it's specified in the will.
Unless it's specified in the will.
That Joni gets this and Bill gets that. And
that's right. And if it's specified in the will, taken care of. But if it's not, you know, what are you going to do with a third of a pearl necklace, for example? It's just not very good. So the executor has the authority to give equal value property to people. So I might give the sterling silver and say it's worth $9,000 to one person, and I might give the china that's worth, say, $8,000 and $1,000 in cash to another person. So you can, the executor has the authority to fairly distribute the property. What we did in my case was when my mom died, she had about 12 pieces of valuable antiques, several paintings, a grand piano, and we played poker. We poured a lot of wine, way too much wine, and we played poker. And
sounds dangerous.
It was very dangerous, but the winner of the poker hand got first pick, and then we went by descending birth order, and then we played another hand. And we got through all of the, we actually got through about 50 pieces of property, and everybody walked away completely satisfied. Two of my sisters did a little bit of a swap of things that they changed their minds on, but we all walked away very happy. And that is a very fair and fun way to divvy this stuff up.
Did your sisters wear sunglasses like the professionals do?
No, but I know one of them cheats. I just know that for sure.
We're speaking with Scott Taylor Smith. He's an attorney. He wrote and has written When Someone Dies, The Practical Guide to the Logistics of Death. Need to take another short break, and we'll come back and take more calls and emails.
This is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM NPR for the Florida Keys. You can visit the Mel Fisher Maritime Museum and discover a place of amazing journeys, Atosha treasure, Harry Potter magic, horrific slave ships, authentic artifacts, and priceless treasures. This historical shipwreck collection tells the story of New World ambition and exploration. The Mel Fisher Maritime Museum, 200 Green Street in Key West. Information at melfishermuseum.org. Brought to you by the Monroe County Tourist Development Council. Tune in to WLRN TV 17 for Anyone and Everyone, an intimate documentary chronicling the coming out of several members of the LGBT community. The special airs on Thursday, June 20th at 9 p.m.
Lynn University invites you to a graduate and evening program open house from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. Wednesday, June 19th on its Boca Raton campus. You can learn all about the new ways programs at Lynn are designed around you, like flexible scheduling and personal attention from professors with real-world experience. You can meet with deans, program chairs, financial aid counselors, complete your application, and register for classes. Reservations available at 561-237-7900 or online at lynn.edu.
And welcome back to Monday's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper. We're speaking with Scott Taylor Smith. He's written When Someone Dies, The Practical Guide to the Logistics of Death. If you want to join in the conversation, the number is 1-800-743-9576. Emails radio at WLRN.org. We have a good question here from emailer Michael. If I don't feel comfortable appointing a family member as an executor or trustee, how can I find a trustworthy person to execute my estate, and what are the approximate charges for this?
That's a great question. Many people look outside the family They don't want to offend siblings by picking one over the other. And so very often it is a very close personal friend. It can also be a more distant relative, like someone who is a cousin or something, but who's in financial services, who is trusted by everybody in the family. I often see people appoint their family lawyer to the task.
That sounds like Dickens.
Yes.
The reading of the will.
The reading of the will. Well, you know, there's a huge case going on right now in New York over a woman who lived in a hospital for the last 20 years of her life, and everyone is fighting for her money. And some of the suspects in that case are people who were involved in writing her will. The most important thing is to make sure you keep reminding yourself about who you'd made your executor in your will, and to make sure that you are updating that. You might fall out of favor with your lawyer or with your good friend, and 10 years later, you still have that person appointed as your executor, and that would be a mistake. So most importantly, write a will, please. 70% of the people in the United States don't have a written will. We're all terrified that if we write our will on Tuesday, a bus is going to strike us dead on Wednesday. And that's just not the case. And you leave your family in complete disrepair if you don't have a will and good instructions. And it's just a horrible problem in this country. And then also keep it in a file where people can find it. Again, that Thanksgiving conversation I talked about, sit down with your elderly parents and ask them, where are the documents? Can I help you put them together? Shall we put them in one file? Because right after someone dies, there's this huge scramble to find access to cash, to find out what was owned by the deceased, and to make sure that, you know, mortgages continue to be paid and various things like that. The question about who gets paid, an executor and a trustee, and a trustee is the person who is in charge of the estate if the estate was a trust, but virtually they're identical, the executor or the trustee. By law, most states mandate that the trustee get paid a fee out of the value of the estate. So in California, I was my mom's executor, and I was entitled to a 2% annual fee, which meant that I was to receive 2% of the assets of the estate every year that the estate was in existence. You can imagine, my sisters were very opposed to my receiving that money. So I didn't need the money, so I donated it to my mom's favorite charity, and that made everybody happy.
Oh, that was good. That was very good. You know, we mentioned about the government. If there is no will, does the government step in? I mean, you hear about safety deposit boxes. Do they confiscate the contents of a safety deposit box? What's that?
Well, that's the escheat laws, and those only come in after property has been abandoned for typically more than 7 years. What happens, if you have a will, then you hopefully have an executor who's taken charge, and the executor will go around with a copy of the death certificate and some document that shows he or she is the executor, and that will get you access to all of the financial information you need.
So you don't have to give them a key to your safety deposit box. Once you're dead and they have a death certificate and they're officially the executor, they can open up.
Yes. Well, now, Joseph, here's the interesting thing. First of all, you've got to find the key. So you've got to make sure you know that you have to know that Dad had a safety deposit box, and hopefully you found the key. Then you go to the bank with the key and evidence that you are the executor, or claim you're the executor. And pending probate or pending, depending on how the estate is being settled, all banks will let you have visual access, which is the vice president will come into the room with you, open the safety deposit box, and allow you to take pictures or photocopies of everything in the box.
Wow, the Hope Diamond is in there.
I wish I was a member of your family.
Yeah, right.
And then once after that is done, so you've done an audit of what's there, then there's a further process by which you actually go and get access once you've either proven the estate is in probate and it's court supervised, or proven that you're not in probate, and then you can get access and take the stuff actually out.
And another quick call, Aurora in Delray Beach. Hi.
Hi. My name is Graciela. I have a situation that my two children live up north. My daughter is in Miami, and my son is in Connecticut. I don't speak with neither of them. They it's a problem issue. Now, I don't want to move to Connecticut. It's too cold. I have my friends, my church, everything in here. But they want me because the insurance, the health insurance will cover me better, they say, in Connecticut. My daughter, I understand she has a daughter that must be around 16 or so years old. Can she be my, what is it called, the
executor.
Executive. And also, what about the insurance? I only have my Social Security.
So can a minor be an executor, Scott?
Yeah. And Graciela, just quickly, are you over 65?
Yes, I'm 78, okay. And I have advanced the beginners of Alzheimer's.
Okay, well then you need to act quickly because people will challenge your ability to write a will. They may end up challenging your mental capacity, so act quickly. An underage person cannot be an executor. They have to be of legal majority in the state in which they're appointed. So I don't know what floor it is. It's either 18 or 21. So you'd have to find somebody else. You could appoint her. And then the court, when you passed away, she was still young, they would appoint a guardian for her. But I think that would be way too risky because she would probably be disqualified. So it would be better to find somebody who you trust, who's a friend, to become your executor. Now, I think another important point, though, that I think you may be getting at is if you're not inclined to give your inheritance to your two children, you should leave everything to your granddaughter, and you should write a will that very clearly says, I'm leaving all of my estate to my granddaughter.
But can't the children challenge that if she has the beginnings of Alzheimer's?
What we'd have to do is we'd have to, Graciela, you would want to go to a lawyer and explain the circumstance, and he or she would help you, come to a point in time where you could prove that you had mental capacity.
Okay.
And it sounds right now, based on this phone call, you certainly sound like you have the capacity. You know what you're doing. You know who your children are. You have all the evidence of capacity to make this decision.
I suppose a doctor could also sign off on that he witnessed the will and that she did have mental capacity.
Yes. And by the way, Graciela, very important, right now, if you grab a pen, you can write your own holographic will, and it will be fully binding. A holographic will is a will that's written entirely in the hand of the deceased and is dated. You do not need witnesses. You don't need anything else. And I would recommend you write that right now and make it clear that you want your granddaughter to inherit everything and give copies to several friends and put your original in your desk drawer.
Okay, Graciela, thanks so much for calling and good luck. And this is Monica, who's written an email. Does a surviving spouse have to pay outstanding medical bills?
Good question, Monica. Again, going back to the example I used earlier, most likely the answer is yes. And the reason is that those debts were incurred in the community of marriage. And so you are half responsible, you are entirely responsible for them. But you have to, this is a question that's very specific to states. In California, the answer would be absolutely yes. In other states, the answer is no. So you have to check with the state.
If you're unmarried, would the estate have to pay?
The estate...
I know,
Joseph,
it depends on the state.
Well, the state always has to pay. In other words, if the estate has the money to pay bills, the state has to pay. The question is, if the estate doesn't, does somebody else have to assume those bills? And the unmarried question is a big question right now. By the way, I want to plug my website. My website is whensomeonedies.net. And I will answer any question that you didn't get answered in the book or in this conversation if you email me on the website.
We'll have that on the Topical Currents Facebook page.
And on the WLRN Topical Currents page.
Oh, good. Thanks.
Yes.
But I just got a question from somebody he has been living with a woman for 20 years, but they've never married. And his question was, is it clear that she's going to inherit? And the answer was no. And, you know, in today's world, we have very unusual, you know, unusual relationships. We have gay relationships. We have common law marriages where you live together and you love each other. You might even have children together, but you never formally married. In those non-traditional relationships, it is imperative that you have something written down, because if you don't, it will that person may be excluded from everything. In California, there's a famous case where Lee Marvin got sued by his ex-girlfriend, and we established case law called Marvin v. Marvin. And in California, there's, if you can prove you were a common law spouse, you can actually inherit. But many states do not allow that. So if you're not legally married, you basically have no rights after someone passes away.
And this just in, Scott, someone, Clay, who was a probate litigator for decades, says handwritten, unwitnessed holographic wills are valid in some states, but they're not valid in Florida.
Oh, thank you very much. Good to know. I appreciate that.
We're speaking...
That's true. That's by state.
Okay, it's by state. So, Graziella, I guess if you're listening, that's not going to work. She has to go to an attorney, right?
She does. Now, Clay will probably validate this. I would go to the Florida State Bar website. Most state bars provide a form of will that you can fill out, that's very easy to fill out, and you don't need a lawyer to do it. I'm assuming if they don't have holographic wills, then that would require two witnesses and potentially a notary. But you don't need a lawyer. If the Florida State Bar has provided one, a form online, if you just fill it out according to the instructions, you'll be fine.
Okay. We're speaking with Scott Taylor Smith. The name of his book is When Someone Dies, The Practical Guide to the Logistics of Death. One more short break and we'll be back.
This is 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. We'll be back to Tropical Currents in just a moment.
For many, a charitable bequest is a unique expression of appreciation. The thoughtfulness of many individual families, like the Levinsons and Fines, has led to planned gifts which help WLRN sustain and grow. Through your will or estate plan, you can name Friends of WLRN as the beneficiary of your estate or a portion of it, providing an enduring legacy of public media for years to come. To learn more about making an impact through planned gifts, call 305-350-7977. You can earn an accredited MBA from Florida Atlantic University. FAU offers a professional MBA on weeknights and an executive MBA on weekends. Programs that start in August include individual leadership assessments and executive coaching, an international trip option, and VIP service. GMAT is waived for qualifying students. Information sessions and more available online at faumba.com. That's faumba.com.
You can find Topical Currents on Facebook, a dedicated page with daily program descriptions, links to our guests, authors, and books. Facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
Well, we're tackling the tough questions with Scott Taylor Smith. He's written When Someone Dies, The Practical Guide to the Logistics of Death. Scott, before we go, once again, that website where people can get more information.
WhenSomeoneDies.net.
And if they want to email you, because we have lots of emails, I don't know if we'll get to all of them, what is your email address?
Oh, my email is ssmith, S-S-M-I-T-H. @viantgroup.com.
Okay.
And Viant is spelled V as in Victor, I-A-N-T,
okay.
group.com.
And we'll take a phone call. This is Craig in Fort Lauderdale. Welcome.
Hi there. I'm a beneficiary of my father's estate, and his wife is the trustee and executor. She's been, I think, less than loyal to the beneficiaries, and sort of either a poker game that you referenced earlier or additional probate litigation. Are there any other methods available to beneficiaries to compel trustees who seem to be not fulfilling their responsibilities to do so?
Oh yeah, boy, that's and it's a very tough situation.
It's
and
a fiduciary role, isn't it, Scott?
It is, and my heart goes out to you. First, the probably the smartest thing to do, if you are as a beneficiary, you are required in most states to receive notice that you are a beneficiary and to be told that you have the right to inspect all of the records, as well, especially the trust. Craig, I would recommend that you provide notice to the attorney and her, if you know she's represented, to both her and her attorney, demanding access to the records to inspect them. Okay. They'll have a very hard time denying you that. That serves two purposes. First of all, you'll be able to read the nature of the trust, and I'm going to come to that in a minute. But secondly, you will put her on notice that you're watching her. And more important, that the attorney will be on notice that you're watching him or her. Now, here is the problem. In most cases, in a family, you have what's called an AB trust. And when dad dies, he names you and your siblings as the principal beneficiaries, but the assets are rolled over to her as an income beneficiary. And depending on how much he trusted your mom or stepmother and various other factors, she may have the right to invade both income and principal for her maintenance of a lifestyle, for health, for education. And in many cases, that grant of authority to invade principal is broad enough that she can basically take a lot of money out without accounting. But that's why it's important for you to get a copy of the document to know what constraints she's legally under. And again, the most important thing is for her to at least, and particularly her advisors, to know that you're watching.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Thanks for your call.
This is Carol. If I leave my home to my only child, is the tax assessment on that home changed when the title is switched to her? Or is there a better way to leave a house to a child than in a will?
There's a much better way. You putting the house in trust would be very smart, because when you put it in trust, there is no change of ownership, technically. Now, ultimately, there will be a change of ownership, but you can defer it. This varies by state law. And many times, inheritances are exempt from reappraisals. In some states, the inheritance does cause a reappraisal of the tax burden.
Okay.
But you could put that property in trust for both the daughter and her children, and then it would remain in trust for a very long period of time, and there would be no tax for quite a while.
Okay. Scott, in the book, you say it's a good idea when you pick an executor to figure in the funeral expenses and have that at their disposal, like $10,000 or something.
Oh, yes, boy. But the first part of, I think, the second chapter of the book talks about get the money quickly. You know, right after someone dies, the first thing we have to do is to figure out if we can access any of the deceased's money. So hopefully there was someone who had a joint checking account. You may even find that you have credit cards that have additional balances available and that you can take a cash withdrawal. But, you know, you need to get a pile of money right away to start paying for everything that comes due. And it's, you know, in addition to the funeral expenses, you have potentially child care, but you always have pet care or garden care. And
oh, yeah. What about the pets?
Yeah. What if you don't make arrangements for your pets? How important is
that?
Well,
oh, it's very important. I mean, anyone who cares about their pet should put a provision in their will talking about what they want done. Many states, almost most states now, have a provision that says, while you cannot leave money directly to Fifi, you can leave money to someone who will care for Fifi for so long as they take care of the dog. And in California, for example, you can designate that money is for the benefit of your dogs and then designate a person to be in charge. There's an immediate issue, though, which is right after someone dies, the first thing we have to think about is just making sure everyone is safe. So if there are children, get the children to someone who you trust. If there are pets, make sure that those pets are taken by someone, whether it's a neighbor or a family member, who you know is going to take care of that pet for while we sort it out.
Right.
And then we have the time to look at who is actually going to inherit or take over. You know, if you're parents, by all means, you have to go write down who's going to be the guardian and be specific about it and make sure you've provided money and access for that guardian so that there is no blip in that child's other than the grief that they're experiencing.
Scott, we just have 1 minute left, but just could you touch on how do you handle the online footprint of the deceased?
Oh, great question. This has become a big issue. You know, Facebook is as but one example. Facebook has a way by which you can notify them that you have a relationship to the deceased. They're very loose about the rules. You just need to prove that you have a relationship. And then they give you access to that person's page so that you can, in Facebook's terms, memorialize it. And you can do whatever you think is appropriate. And most other sites do that. But I want to talk quickly about notice. By all means, make sure you provide vast notice to people about someone having passed away. Don't think it's an imposition. Let people know. People really want to know and want to come and help.
Well, we certainly want to thank you. It's been a very interesting and sobering hour.
Went a little too quickly, but...
We've been visiting with Scott Taylor Smith, and he's the author of When Someone Dies, The Practical Guide to the Logistics of Death. Thank you very much, Scott. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for tuning in this hour. Apologies to those we couldn't get on the air. Topical Currents producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Of course, we have free audio archives and downloads of this and past programs at our website, WLRN.org. More information and additional links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program begins with British journalist John Paul Flintoff, author of How to Change the World. He has 198 ways. Also literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez with FIU professor Deborah Dean, author of the historical novel The Mirrored Walls. And the calendar for June 17th, on this day in 1885, 128 years ago, the Statue of Liberty arrives in New York. It's actually on the New Jersey side of New York Harbor. Its internal iron structure was designed by Gustav Eiffel. And on this day, 1917, 96 years ago, the birth of African-American author Gwendolyn Brooks in Topeka, Kansas. The first black to win a Pulitzer Prize in 1950. One more while we revere the killer. On this day in 1957, 56 years ago, Jerry Lee Lewis's Whole Lot of Shakin' Goin' On enters the Billboard charts after he played it on The Steve Allen Show. We leave with lines from poet Gwendolyn Brooks. How we finally undressed and whipped out the light and flowed into bed and lay loose-limbed for a moment in the weekend bright bedclothes, then gently folded into each other. When you have, I say, forgotten all that, then you may tell, then I may believe, you have forgotten me as well. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This is 91.3